Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
My Auntie Greta loved rainy days. In the nursing home, where old age and arthritis had tethered her to a high-backed chair, she told us her love of rain stemmed from the early part of her life on a big, busy Fermanagh farmhouse on the shores of Loch Earn. There, she said, she loved to wake up under the eaves to the sound of rain thudding on the slate roof above her head. A wet day meant an easy, or at least an easier day, with less outdoors work. All through my childhood, I had heard Auntie Greta described as being so strong and hardworking, she could do the farm work of any man. Heaving milk churns, carting buckets of feed to calves, herding cattle. You might say Greta was lucky for having been born into a big, prosperous farm with its large two-storey slate-roofed house. She was not lucky, however, in being a big-boned, plain girl, with no rush of suitors to give her a home and a life of her own. Greta's destiny, it appeared, was that of an unpaid farmhand who'd look after her parents in their old age. Her hopes had been raised when Paddy Joe, from outside Ballyshannon, just across the border here in Donegal, began a weekly courtship of her, cycling the 6 miles to her home with a bag of emerald toffees for her. PJ had already set tongues wagging by building a tiny one-roomed slate-roofed house for himself, so small that, in his own words, if anyone comes in the front, they'll have to back out as there's not room to turn around. The assumption was that he'd extend the house when he got married. A mountain of toffees were consumed over the years, but the one-roomed house grew no bigger. This sliver of a dream must have faded for Greta as she entered her 40s and an age when, as the locals put it, there was no risk of a pram in the hallway. Greta appeared to have no option but to accept her place. But what happened next took on the status of a fairy tale for me as a child. A real-life prince, in the unlikely guise of Tony, a retired guard for Buncrana, came to the rescue of my much-loved Auntie Greta. She was crossing the border to Ballyshannon on her bicycle one wet day when she got a puncture. This left her stranded in no man's land, between the northern and southern customs huts, equidistant from her home and her destination. A devoutly religious man, Tony was on his way home from his annual 3-day pilgrimage to Loch Derg when, stopping at the customs, he spotted the wet and forlorn Greta. He went to help, put her bicycle into the boot of his car and gave her a lift to Ballyshannon. Greta never told us exactly what was said on that journey, but evidently, by the time they reached Ballyshannon, what should have been an ending became instead a beginning. A barely imaginable future unfolded for both of them. As unlikely a couple as they may have seemed to others, they must have seen in each other the potential to meet their deepest longings. I still remember the flurry of disbelief mixed with some envy within the family, when, in a very short time, without a by your leave, Greta was married and queen of her own castle, a neat townhouse on the main street of Buncrana, as far removed from her isolated house as could be imagined. She blossomed in this new life, delighting in having neighbours, shops, a chapel she could walk to, and most magical of all, a beach on her doorstep. I know all this from when I stayed with her on my summer holidays. Sitting together on a bench by the sea, eating 99s, I felt I would burst with happiness. Her home was to me, coming from a large, rambunctious family of seven, truly a palace. Spotless, with the jewel colours of statues and holy pictures in every room. Tony was a kind presence who would gently chide Greta when she wondered, should she let me watch Top of the Pops on the black and white TV? Let the child enjoy herself, he'd say. Greta shared 20 happy years with Tony and lived on in Buncrana until after his death. In her old age, she moved back to a nursing home in Beleek. She rests now in Buncrana beside her gentle prince. Here in Ballyshannon, whenever I walk past the ruins of Paddy Joe's tiny house, where he lived out the rest of his life alone, eating toffees, I think of Greta and Tony's tranquil happiness in that townhouse, where the sound of fat raindrops clattering on a roof were no longer needed as a refuge from life. Thank you.
So, are you single? It's a question that carries a range of implied meanings, depending on who's asking and where. In a bar, it can be a statement of romantic intent. At a wedding, where you've come without a plus one, it's usually spoken with a pitying tone. But I'm not sure that anyone's written the etiquette guide for when it's put to you by a formidable group of Croatian women in a public library in Zagreb. I was in Croatia on a 2-month intercultural education project, one of 10 volunteers from all over Europe. Initially, my education consisted of useful tidbits like learning to swear in Slovak and gamble with Portuguese card games. But eventually, the time came for me to become a teacher, and I was asked to give a presentation on Ireland to a local Zagreb pensioners association who were learning English. I arrived at the library for the presentation, armed with a USB stick, holding a slideshow that I'd put together the night before. It was a big ask to condense an entire nation's culture, history, and ambience into 20 slides with suitably pretty pictures. I had to try and convey the beauty and wonder of Ireland, as seen through the eyes of a dual national born in London, to an audience who had most likely never set foot on Irish soil. I was a little nervous. I wasn't helped by the fact that all the chairs were arranged in a single straight row, facing me directly, like the world's biggest job interview panel. The exclusively female audience eyed me with slight suspicion as I fumbled with the projector, finally bringing up my first slide. There were a few murmurs as one of the ladies nudged her neighbor and pointed at a line of text in Croatian that I'd included. It was meant to say, "Greetings from Ireland," but judging from the disappointed head shaking, I must have managed to make some kind of translation error. Hoping whatever I'd ended up saying wasn't too offensive, I clicked through to the next slide as casually as possible. After a few standard facts about area, population, and general all-round greenness, I was confronted with the Herculean task faced by every Donegal person when speaking to someone unfamiliar with Irish geography. While there are many wonderful things about coming from Donegal, its location on a map isn't one of them. The concept that Donegal is in the north of Ireland, but not in Northern Ireland, can be a tricky one for someone who doesn't have English as a first language. I've even known it to cause some confusion among Irish passport holders too, so we can't entirely blame the language barrier. Deciding to sidestep the issue altogether, I displayed a map of Ireland and waved vaguely at the top left corner, making no attempt to discuss the intricate geopolitical nature of the border counties. We got through the Gaeltacht, St. Patrick's Day, and the National Ploughing Championship with a minimum of fuss, and I opened the floor to questions, expecting perhaps something about shamrocks or the point scoring system in Gaelic football. Instead, one of the ladies, who'd been sitting with her arms crossed and her brow furrowed, raised her hand. Then came the question, "Are you single?" For a second or two, I was thrown. If I answered yes, would an eligible granddaughter be ushered immediately into the room? But wasn't it embarrassing to have to admit to a room full of women that you weren't able to hold down a stable relationship at the age of 27? Lying about it did cross my mind, but I decided against it, reasoning that at least one of the group probably possessed occult powers to detect that kind of thing. I even found space in my head to regret not including the Lisdoonvarna matchmaking festival in my presentation. Clearly, I'd misread the interests of my target audience. But my inquisitor needed an answer. So I bit the bullet and said, "Yes, I am single," then waited for the barrage of follow-up questions. But they didn't come. Instead, the lady seemed satisfied, and the rest of the row nodded in collective consent. We moved on to whether Ireland was an expensive country for tourists to visit and other uncontroversial topics. I managed to wrap up the session without a single further reference to my relationship status. To this day, I still can't figure out the motivation behind the question. Maybe it was just idle curiosity. Or maybe it was to plant a seed, because by the time I left Zagreb a month later, the answer to that question, "Are you single?" had become no. And from our subsequent meetings in Frankfurt, Vienna, Bratislava, I've discovered that a long-distance international relationship is one of the best intercultural educations of all, which is a line that the advertising guys at Lisdoonvarna are welcome to use if they're looking to broaden their global appeal.
Thank you. I had a passion for arithmetic when I was about 5 years old, but I lost it. By the time I turned into my teens, I would shudder at the sight of a simple sum. I couldn't be counted on to numerically quantify the human experience. No one told me about the essential cosmic beauty of mathematics. Or maybe I wasn't at school that day. Or maybe I was a million miles away. I was drifting. School was a distraction from the more important stuff I had to be getting on with. I liked Latin for a couple of weeks too, but that wore off fast. We had an old record player at home, and that might have been part of the problem. As far as I was concerned, there was much more happening inside songs than there was anywhere else. If maths had been taught through song, I might have been a mathematician, but it wasn't, so I'm not. I was fond of fresh air and singing. I was worried that we were all being herded into indoor jobs where you couldn't sing when you felt like it. Some people manage very well, saving their singing for the end of the day. I wouldn't be able. Fresh air and singing suggested to me a career as a hobo blues singer. I could do that. When I was being admonished and diminished for my poor grasp of the language of the Holy Roman Empire, the knowledge that I would one day be a hobo blues singer, sleeping in barns, that's what kept me going. Then punk happened. I was 16. Suddenly everything made sense. I got expelled from school, and by the end of my 17th year, I was squatting in London. There's ambition. There was lots of young Irish in London living in squats. It's a whole aspect of the national narrative that has been hitherto neglected. Firstly, people didn't want their mothers to know, because what would the neighbours think? Secondly, when people came home and had their own kids, they didn't want to be saying, oh, when I was your age, I was squatting in London. Wasn't going to happen. Punk was about uncensored self-expression. It was about immediacy and feeling empowered. Before it became fashion, it rejected fashion. It sowed the seeds of disruption, but didn't provide any solutions. It was a start, not an end. Thrashing guitars were great. Three chords and the truth will always hold true. But the freedom to evolve meant it was bound to move on. And the squats were like a university of sorts. Young artists could afford to leave home and live in the heart of London. Books were read and poems written. Walls were painted. Interiors decorated. Conversations had and music was made. Politics mostly inclined towards the dismantling of Maggie Thatcher's England, confronting the National Front and an end to nuclear proliferation. And I was evolving as a human being. However, I had a hankering for somewhere else. That beloved place I'd left behind. So I came back to Ireland and became the hobo I always wanted to be. Rain and the lack of access to freight trains with boxcars meant I had to temper my dreams. But more than 40 years later, I can safely say it worked out better than I could possibly have imagined. I avoided the sort of job that scared me so much. When I want to sing the blues, I sing the blues. But I woke up this morning with a small doubt in my head. The arts have blossomed, but it has to be said there's a quagmire of bureaucracy. There's no end of form filling required, and administration ad infinitum. So here I am doing sums and struggling with an academic language of arts administration that would leave Latin in the halfpenny place. While all my school peers are starting to take early retirement, buying camper vans and spending their pensions driving around singing all day. There is no punk pension plan. No punk wedding bands to supplement income. Anyway, I don't really play punk music. I've evolved. I play eccentric, gentle punk. It's a small market. A very small market. Tiny. So yes, it's a fine mess I've gotten myself into. And it's a bit late for turning now. I'll soon be 60. See what happened? One small doubt turned a hugely successful career into a dust bowl of dreams. I love my life, but nobody wants to hear songs about bumblebees and nettle soup. It's not fashionable. Those hipsters seem to have plenty of disposable income. There's millions of them splashing cash on mustache wax and beard manicures. Maybe I could start writing hipster songs about drinking beer from microbreweries and getting my Wellington boots muddy at boutique festivals. They're all very urban, though. Do you know what hipsters love more than anything? Dystopia.
Dandelion seeds on the breeze, everyone loves days like these. Meadow flowers scent the air, gambling lambs everywhere. Baby blue sky, clouds so fluffy, but there's nowhere nearby to buy decent coffee. I can't take much more of this, sick to my teeth of rural bliss. I want dystopia, like in all my favorite books. Dystopia, dystopia. I want a landscape that's been nuked. All together, everybody. Dystopia, 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 dystopia. Come on, help an old punk get his pension in order. Everybody, all together. One, two, three. Dystopia, 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 dystopia. I want a landscape that's been nuked.
Not a lot of people outside the Northwest know of Leitrim's 3-mile coastline, but for those who live in it, who from it hail, it has helped define who we are. Tullahan Village is where the county dips its toe into the waters of the Atlantic. It's neither a port nor a fishing village, but still harbours the qualities of a place with one foot planted in rock and the other in water. In its heyday, it shared the casual lawlessness of an island visited only on occasion by a Garda whose token appearance is forewarned to all by the ferryman. Tullahan also possesses the opportunism of any border place and the Mehill mentality necessary to any outpost. In the early 1980s, a phone would ring in the Maguire's house. If the call came from one of my brothers in London or Germany, Mary Maguire would jump in the car and drive the 3 miles to our townland of Derrylohan to let Mum and Dad know that Barber or Davy or John would call again in half an hour. And so one of my favourite little adventures was set in motion as we piled into our car and made for Maguire's, home of one of the few phones in the area at the time. There were many elements to such an outing, each sparking my curiosity and illuminating my understanding of the world. Catching up on the adventures of my brothers always took precedence. Each of us was offered a bare 60 seconds to quiz them on life and what they might bring home. usually coinciding with Christmas. Once this was taken care of, our attention would turn to play. Sean Maguire was nestled in age exactly between myself and my older brother Gordon, and so helped to bridge that four-year gap. My younger brother and I, numbers 11 and 12 in the family, are Irish twins, Stuart's birthday coming just 361 days after my own. My older sisters, Karen and Alison, were similar in age to Patrice and Dee Dee Maguire. The teenage Maguire girls were dark and exotic creatures with a hint of Spanish Armada about them. Old enough to inhabit a different world and, even if I didn't quite know why, beautiful enough to make me want to visit it sometime in the future. From the Maguire's backyard, you could throw a stone into the sea if the tide was in. In high tide or high wind, their back garden would fill with foam from the waves below, and I always feared that their house might flood, but it never did. There was no boundary at the bottom of the lane. It just edged down onto the rocky coast and transitioned into another landscape. To the right, in Tullahan, we were bound by the mouth of the Drowes River. To the left, we rarely ventured beyond Tent Lodge, which looked out over the coast and across to Donegal Bay, its folly stone tower standing like the last sentinel of a forgotten chieftain's army. Even as a child, its fading grandeur struck me. It was clear that it belonged to another era and that it was threatened as much by the indifference of modern Ireland as the eroding coastline below its boundary walls. As we roamed the coast, we would hopscotch the rocks to develop our balance and to beachcomb for anything worthwhile we could find. For it was the rocks that would decide what gifts they might offer to the sure-footed few who first reached their bounty. My most exciting find was a message in a bottle that had made its way from a high school student in Newfoundland in just a matter of months. I got permission to call the number on the letter, but when I finally got to talk to the girl who'd sent it, I was mightily disappointed. She didn't sound at all that impressed. She told me she'd report where and when it was found to her science teacher, but inexplicably, no all-expenses-paid invitation to regale her classmates with story of my recovery was forthcoming. I still have the letter, though, and a love for the coast, and a need for its healing water. Shortly after my brother Gordon died in a car crash in 2002, aged 30, our family headed together to Tullahan's coast, with our grief draped about our shoulders like seaweed on the rocks. We found the tide had bowed its head and humbly receded to expose Leitrim's little oasis of sand. And we sat on our private beach as the sun came out from behind Tent Lodge, and the family's next generation played and made sandcastles and little plans of their own. As we walked into the water together, three generations and a fourth soon to follow, I looked back on Tullahan, knowing that soon the waves would wash away the footprints of my parents and the castles of their grandchildren, and that nothing could turn back that tide. And so we celebrated a life well lived.
Don't get left behind. The American poet Maya Angelou used to say that whenever she gave a poetry reading, she brought the spirit of everyone who had ever been kind to her on stage with her. She would say, "Come with me. I need your help. I need you now." And it gave her courage. I try to follow that advice now. I said those words just before this reading. Sometimes during a conversation with friends about poetry, I end up saying, "Did I ever tell you my Seamus Heaney story? I have a lovely memory of Seamus Heaney." The preamble to my story begins years ago, when as an adult learner, I enrolled for a foundation studies course in McGee College, Derry. I was searching for something, a kindling that could spark a glimmer. I had stayed at home when our sons were young, but they were growing up, and I needed to move forward. The foundation studies involved a range of subjects, and luckily for me, one of the subjects was English, and it included poetry. And luckily for me, the lecturer gave us some Heaney poems to look at. I had never heard of Seamus Heaney before that time. I held a trepidation when it came to poetry. I thought I needed a teacher to explain a poem to me before I could appreciate it. The first Heaney poem that was put before us was The Docker. And as I read it, something in me shifted. I understood the poem and could appreciate the wordplay in his chosen images. I felt a sense of achievement. Seamus Heaney himself, in a video discussion, is in conversation with the poet Dennis O'Driscoll. Heaney describes first reading contemporary poetry when he was in his 20s. He said it gave him an eagerness, excitement, a sense of change. A moment of writing gave him a lift, a joy, a reward. That was exactly how I felt on reading The Docker. There was a grace for me in discovering his poems. The kindling I had carried into McGee College was set alight, and I began writing poetry. My life took a whole new direction. So, we move forward in my story to years after that first learning, to an evening in West Donegal, a poetry event where I was asked to compare. I was really looking forward to that evening. I knew I would be introducing each writer and musician, but I would also be reading three of my own poems. And I knew that Seamus Heaney and Mary Heaney were in Donegal, and they would be in the audience. I felt comfortable comparing the event. The hall was full, and the audience was warm and appreciative. I was enjoying myself. I introduced several poets and musicians, and then it was my turn to perform as a poet. I said the title of my first poem, and then I thought, Seamus Heaney is listening to me. The thought began to drumbeat louder and louder within me. Seamus Heaney is listening to my poems. I started to shake, a nervous tremble that started at my toes and moved up my body. I could barely stand up. The nerves were rapidly coming close to strangling my voice. My husband and friends were sitting in the audience. I could see their expression of utter disbelief as they watched me quivering. When it came to the end of the first poem, I thought, I will not get through the next two poems unless I own my nerves. So I said into the mic, it's not easy when you are told, read a few poems, and oh, Seamus Heaney will be in the audience. There was a silence for a moment, and then, from the back of the darkened hall, a voice rang out, you're doing grand, Denise. You're doing grand. Mr. Heaney himself. I started to laugh. The audience laughed. I settled into myself and finished reading two poems, nerve-free. Afterwards, at the end of the evening, I went down the hall to Mary and Seamus, and I said to them, I can always now say that Seamus Heaney heckled me. Mary laughed and she said, ach, sure, that wasn't a heckle. And then Seamus looked at me in that enriching way that he had, and he said, you could read anywhere at any time, daughter. It was that word, daughter, that grounded when he said it, made it feel sincere and encouraging. And now, when I'm doing a reading, and I feel nerves are about to invade, I hear him. You could read anywhere, at any time, daughter. And my soul settles. Thank you, Seamus. You were a gentleman.
So is the moon, and we all feel the pool of the water. And just like the tide, hearts spill over sometimes, and then we have sorrow or laughter. Dark must know. Sometimes gray descends on my day, and my feet on the ground feel unstable. I'll stretch out my hands and use them as wands, just because we're all equal. And our palms they will touch, and it might feel too much, 'cause it's hard to get used to the feeling. But when the current runs through between me and you, that's how we know we are healing. The listeners are there, and none of us here are forsaken, and the dreamers of dreams, the painters of scenes, the dancers and poets are all waking. We all have the chance to live in this spell, and all we must do now is want it. Then we can become listeners as well, turn the everyday to enchanted. What a thought that is, being together as one. There's a magic in it somehow. Well, it's us and the tide and the moon. Together in the here and now. Yeah, it's us and the tide and the moon and the sun. We're all together in the here and now.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the program on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.